Off the Ball.
In association with the Air Sport app, allowing you to cast your favourite sporting action from your tablet or mobile phone straight to your TV.
You're welcome back. So if you're just tuning in, for the past 30 minutes or so, we were in conversation with our courts correspondent, Frank Graney. That was very much a recap of the Belfast rape trial. We're going to move away from that now in the main. And beyond some very direct points, the following conversation, I assure you, is not in any way a commentary on that trial involving Paddy Jackson and Stuart Olding. It is far more general. This has been an unbelievably high-profile trial. It has involved some high-profile sports people. And we certainly feel in here it has raised many issues worth addressing and discussing. Those issues, for obvious reasons, are rarely addressed on a show like this. But we're going to take the opportunity to do so this evening. Those topics do include the legal process, but particularly consent. And in some respects, we will hit on things which seem like obvious basics, and I appreciate that about the issue of consent, but we're going to do it anyway, and maybe it's an issue that we're not talking about enough in the country. So if you're unhappy with any of that, by all means, please switch off the coverage. We will have the football show later. We'll have Brian Robson in studio, and we'll have sport around 10 past, quarter past 8 or so. So that will all be on the way. But for the time being, we have Nolene Blackwell on the line, a human rights lawyer and chief executive of the Dublin Rape Crisis Centre. And we have Phelim O'Neill with us as well, a solicitor who works in this area. So firstly, Nolene, before we move on to that more general chat we're hoping to try and have, your observations and thoughts on the past 8 weeks.
So what we have noticed over the period of this trial is that while it's not necessarily that a lot more people have been contacting the national helpline that the Dublin Rape Crisis Centre runs, but that much more people are referring to the trial when they contact the helpline or when they, for those who are coming in to us for therapy when they come in. So this particular case has certainly raised a much bigger debate around the whole question of what constitutes consent in sexual activity and what does not. And it has also shone a spotlight on how we run sexual offences trials. And certainly I can say that since the verdict came out earlier today, there has been huge pressure on our phone lines with people who... with people contacting us, people who, you know, have been involved in situations themselves, and people who believe that the system isn't a good one. And so in general,
yeah,
I think this has been a case which has been very difficult for everybody involved in the case. I think no single one of them, none of the defendants nor the complainant, ever saw a life in which they would spend 2.5 months in a court in under this kind of barrage and this kind of scrutiny. So I think it has been very hard on all of them. And if anything good came out of this case, then it is if we can look again and see how we actually deal with issues of consent and how we identify how you do criminal trials in a way that is more respectful to all involved.
Yeah. It's opened my eyes, I must say. And this has been a very high profile case. Because it's in the north, the public is not excluded from rape trials. The complainant, the accused certainly, are named, which doesn't happen down in the Republic. So that has led to a much higher profile. But for instance, I mean, like the experience of the alleged or the complainant, Nolene,
yeah,
8 days in the witness box,
yeah,
struck me as excessive, and this a very adversarial common law type approach. I mean, and the public looking on, I mean, I must say, I think it's a very positive thing we don't have that down here, just seemed harrowing in the extreme and unbelievably personal, horrific details to recount.
Yes, and taking just that portion of it, which is common actually to both jurisdictions. In, as you say, down south, we don't have that publicity around it and we don't have the public in. But at the same time, the person who makes the complaint is in the same position. They're put in the chair, in the spotlight. And in this case, the complainant was examined by five teams of lawyers. The first team of lawyers were for the Crown, the prosecution, and took her through the evidence she had already given. Mm. And that took a day. And then for the next six full days and another bit of a day, four teams for each of the defence questioned her. And Paddy Jackson's lawyers questioned her for 3 days and then the others for various times between them. And she is there the whole time sitting in a spotlight without any legal team herself. And the job, the proper job of the defendant, of the people who were accused of it, as Phelan will speak to this much better than I will,
yeah.
But their job was to rock her evidence, to find inconsistencies. Mm. So they were allowed, it is part of the legal system that allowed them to call her a liar, self-deluded, mistaken, forgot, all of these things in an attempt to identify what inconsistencies were in her evidence, because that is what the juror, is what would be going to the jurors to make a decision on. But it is that sort of constant onslaught, no matter what you thought of the truth of anyone's case, in this case, most people were appalled at the vision of somebody sitting unrepresented, unminded, in a sense, and wave after wave of questions, the same questions in different ways, coming at her again and again. It would not have been allowed, we'll say, in a police station to the same extent, because but it was allowed here and it was permitted here because that's the way we run it.
Phelan, if we talk about the other issues which maybe go against the complainants or the victims, the alleged victims in these trials generally, the burden of proof is the other huge issue here. I mean, beyond all reasonable doubt, those words weigh very, very heavily, I think, in the minds of all jurors anywhere, because beyond all reasonable doubt is a very, very difficult thing. Can you give us your take on the system, where it can be improved? And, you know, look, the flip side of beyond all reasonable doubt is that if you or I were ever accused wrongly, absolutely I want beyond all reasonable doubt. And we would want that for any of our family members as well.
Absolutely. I am a solicitor who has quite a deal of experience defending people who are accused of these types of crimes. Certainly, it's much more difficult for the prosecution to secure a conviction in this jurisdiction because there's a very high threshold. The prosecution must prove their case beyond a reasonable doubt. And if you ask me as a defence lawyer, I say that's the way it should be. You see, it's important, I think, that the threshold is very high because often these cases amount to swearing matches. I very rarely, and in fact this case up in Belfast is quite unusual because in defending these cases, I very rarely come across a case where there's a witness because it's just not the nature of this type of crime.
Yeah.
More often than not, it's a he said, she said scenario. More often than not, medical evidence is inconclusive. In fact, I'd say over the past 8 years in dealing with this type of crime, I have never seen conclusive evidence being brought forward by a medical practitioner, which makes it very, very difficult for a defendant accused of a sexual offence to clear his name. So the notion that the beyond a reasonable doubt or that very high threshold should for some reason be reduced, I would argue very strongly against. Mm. Because, quite frankly, I regularly have cases where a defendant is accused and he has no way of proving his innocence other than simply to walk into a Garda station and say, I didn't do it.
Yes. Statistically, Nolan, how common are prosecutions once a case goes to trial?
So how common are prosecutions is one thing because it is an area where reporting is notoriously low. And from whatever evidence we have, which is not good enough, we don't have enough work done in surveys in this area and studies. Mm-hmm. But it looks like that only about 10% of people will ever report sexual violence at all. And then of those that do report, there's a huge falling off between the time someone reports to the Gardaí and the time a case would come to court. And again, it looks like about 90% of people fall off for one reason or another over that period. Now, there's a load of reasons why people might fall off. They might just get sick of the process. They might be pressured into withdrawing their evidence. The evidence mightn't be there. The Gardaí mightn't have enough evidence to go forward. But when cases then go to, cases of rape go to court, again, it's not that easy to work from the court statistics. But I was looking at the last annual report of the courts, and it showed that 404 charges of rape had been brought. Now, you know, that doesn't mean 404 people, because some people would have more than one charge against them. But yeah, 404 charges were brought. And of those, about 70% resulted in conviction, and the other 30% resulted in acquittal.
Okay. So, and do we know, is that massively out of kilter with other crimes?
It looks like this particular area, the detection rate is extraordinarily low. In terms of convictions.
Once you actually get into a courtroom,
I think
you
it's
get
not
into a
normal
courtroom
for convictions.
Phelan,
I
would you
say
know
Phelan.
once you get into a courtroom? Because I'm not underplaying even your 10% reportage stat, Nolan, because that is just depressingly frightening. But once you get into a courtroom, Phelan, would 70% conviction rate, would that be standard or below or higher?
I would be surprised if it's as high as 70% conviction rate. But I do accept, if Nolan has done the research, I accept that to be true. Certainly, from my experience, we would not be dealing with 70% conviction rate, at least in contested trials. So I'm not sure when Nolan was looking at the statistics, is she bringing into, are those trials that actually ran the course, or does that include people who plead guilty?
Yes, it includes people who plead guilty as well.
If it includes people who plead guilty, well, then the statistic is totally skewed, because the reality of it is, I would say, from my own experience, probably closer to 85 or 90% would be acquitted of those who actually fight these cases.
Right, okay. And is that out of kilter with other crimes?
Certainly.
It is?
Yes.
Okay. So 85 to 90% of those who contest the charges are acquitted.
Yeah.
And, do we have any idea what the standard would be across the courts, Phelan?
I wouldn't know, but certainly, you see, I think the difficulty with, from the prosecution's point of view in these sort of cases, are there are no, you know, there's no hard evidence for the most part. Yeah. There's no witnesses, there's no CCTV. As I said previously, medical evidence is often inconclusive. So it can be very difficult for the prosecution to bring home a conviction.
Yeah.
Whereas in other crimes, you know, there's usually something else. You know, people can be caught red-handed. It's not quite so easy in this type of matter.
I do want to move on to consent, but I suppose a question to both of you, who are both working at various angles of this whole situation. So is there anything that can be done, along with having legal support in court for the alleged victim or the complainant in these scenarios, which you've mentioned, Nolan, but is there anything that can be done to improve the process, to improve the experience for the victims, to make them more likely to report, which very crucially would not diminish, I think, a justifiably high burden of proof? Mm. Nolan, I might put that to you first if there's anything, and then I'll come to Phelan.
Yes. So there are a number of things that could be done right from the start of reporting. And I won't bore you with it, because I could go on for an hour on this particular one.
Okay.
But there is, first of all, one of the things to be recognized in this area of crime, which is very different to others, is that people are reporting a crime where they are a victim and where the impact on them is very often highly traumatic. And therefore, the collection of the evidence day one is really important by the Gardaí. So while there are now, there's a slow movement towards the recognition of the need for specialized Gardaí to investigate sexual violence, it's far too slow. So one of the things you would do is you would collect the evidence in a better way. Then in relation to an awful lot of vulnerable witnesses, there are much better ways of interviewing and collecting evidence where we could learn a lot, not just from the neighbouring jurisdiction of the UK, which is where we always look, but to European jurisdictions as well, where you have special protections for vulnerable witnesses, where the way you investigate is more like trying to tease out the evidence rather than like the swearing match that we have here. So there are a number of things that you could do, and in fact we will have to do it, because since last year at a European Union level, there has to be, the courts have to take into account the rights of victims not to be re-traumatized by the court process. And that was the reason why, for instance, ever before the Belfast trial started to take off, we put in a submission to the Law Reform Commission, which is the government's think tank on this area,
yeah,
just saying, can we look at the whole journey of the victim through the justice system and identify ways in which their rights could be recognised without in any way denying the right of an accused to a fair hearing.
Okay, well, I might go with that for the time being. Phelim, is that doable while still respecting the rights of the accused?
I think to an extent it is, but I don't think it's wise to push it too far, to the extent that perhaps, you know, there can be issues where a victim is supposed to be perhaps like a perfect victim, that they cannot have a history that should be questioned. And we saw this up in the case up in Belfast. There's a lot of criticism perhaps levelled against the defence teams for the way in which they attacked the character of the complainant.
Mm-hmm.
But nevertheless, the system isn't totally broken here, because if you take that highly dangerous strategy of attacking someone's character, your own character can be brought to the fore. So there are a certain number of safeguards already in place. But I do agree with what Nolan's saying with regard to how evidence is collected and how victims are handled, and making the process easier. I think that would certainly be welcome.
Okay. Let's turn to consent, where this whole case really hinged on in many ways. So growing up, many of us, Nolan, are the depiction of rape we saw in the media was very clear cut. It was a dark alley and there was a woman walking home alone and a rapist came up and it was violent and clear cut. And we all understood that was abhorrent in every way. What we are talking about here is a much grayer issue. In a perfect world, there would be verbal consent.
Yeah.
But I think we can all agree, and let's have a real conversation here, that human sexual activity is not always straightforward or uniform. And so the floor is yours. I want to follow your lead here. Like I said, I was never talked about in school about consent.
Yeah.
Family, it never came up. Friends, it never came up. I took it as a fairly straightforward issue. So where do we start here?
So I'm given that it's so important because sex without consent is rape. It's really, and sexual activity without consent is sexual assault. So it's really important that we get this right. And it is true, added to all the things you said just there, is the other thing that as Irish people, we're not that great at saying yes and no. You know, we're kind of great at saying, ah, sure, it'll be all right, or, ah, no, it doesn't matter. Or, you know, we don't say yes and no clearly.
Yeah.
And one of the great things that's happening in some young people's schools and transition classes is where young people themselves are identifying how to say yes and how to say no, and how to hear yes and how to hear no. So it's, you know, it's a different way of talking. It is a way of being more straightforward in recognizing that it's not all about you. It's about you and your partner and your joint agreement to take sexual activity wherever you want to take it, consensually. And that is something that, in fact, we say it's going to be very hard in sexual activity. I don't think it's going. I think maybe we haven't tried hard enough. In a lot of our schools, there is no conversation about it whatsoever. As you say, people are not talking about it amongst their friends. But in some schools, there is the conversation now and people are talking about it. It's doable, Joe. That's the thing.
Yes. A question for both of you. How often do you come across cases where there is a rape victim making their complaint and the perpetrator has no idea that he has raped that victim?
Very often, from my perspective. I have come across circumstances where individuals have been arrested the morning after they have engaged in what they believe to be consensual relations. And it makes it incredibly difficult. And although I accept what Nolan is saying, I don't think it is quite as simple, and it's quite clear actually from practicing in the area that it's not as simple as yes or no, because often somebody says yes to the act of engaging in sexual relations, but that can go too far. It might become too strong, for instance. And what they initially consented to may not have transpired in the act. So it's not as simple as yes or no. It's yes, but it's also, you know, you have to understand what they're saying yes to, if that makes sense.
If I can just come in on that, because I think it is. I actually disagree with Phelim on that. I think it is that simple. I think we haven't worked out what it is, because even to take that example that he spoke of, where, you know, somebody agrees to one thing and then it becomes too strong or becomes something else. Well, we don't see that in any other area. In physical activity, we recognize that somebody may agree to a particular physical activity does not give you the right to go further. I think we have a lot to learn. I think we can learn a lot. And from our point of view here, a lot of the people that we deal with, who are for the most part the victims of some form of sexual violence, or they are the supporters of those people, for all of those, they know they have been hurt and traumatized themselves. For some of them, they know that the person who hurt them, who assaulted them, will not admit it, and sometimes will not know it. Very often, they will not be taking those cases anywhere near the Gardaí. So what Phelim sees is at a different level, because there are those who've gone to the Gardaí. Mm. I can assure you, we get a lot of people in here where the people who hurt them are absolutely not listening. They don't care. And they are overriding the wishes of the people who come in to us. So there's such a range. It is indeed true, we also come across people who did not know that what they were doing was an assault, did not know what they were doing was a rape.
What do they tend to say? What do they tend to say, the people who didn't know?
I suppose we're working with victims, and a lot of the time we will be trying to empower people to be able to talk to the person who didn't know.
Yeah.
I mean, that would be part of what we would be doing. And okay. But a lot of the time, people don't care. And we need to work very heavily to ensure that everybody recognizes. And this is not about the case that's going on at all. This is about our work in general. People have to care about whether their partner is consenting.
Yes.
That's where we really can make progress, and we need to make progress.
I don't know if it's helpful or not, but I'll throw examples out there. So, Phelim, two people wake up in a bed hungover the next morning. They've been out, they've had a few drinks, they've had sex, they're naked in the bed the next morning, and neither of them gave each other the consent. Has one raped the other? Are they both potentially rape victims? What's that?
You see, again, does consent really have to be verbalised? Two consenting adults, for the most part, are going to know when they've gone too far. And alcohol, you're right, does play a huge part. And in my practice, I regularly come across circumstances where alcohol was involved. And it's difficult from both sides, because sometimes it can cloud the memory of the person who's accused. But also, I think from the complainant's point of view, it can also pose a difficulty. Perhaps they have engaged in something that they would not have engaged in had they not consumed alcohol. It makes the area very, very difficult to navigate, particularly when alcohol is in the equation.
Yeah. Nolan?
Yes, that's absolutely right. And again, to be clear, if somebody has sex with somebody who is not capable of fully consenting, the person who has the sex with them is officially raping them.
Yeah. 100%. So, I was bringing up a slightly different example. Yeah. Both parties are hazy.
Yeah,
both,
yeah, yeah.
You know,
so, there's two elements for us in our work here where again, so many people actually never end up going to the police, so it's not a matter of a crime.
Yeah.
So when two people wake up the following morning, if one of them believes they have been raped, that is their experience that they have been raped. They may not have enough evidence if they go to the police to be able to bring a criminal charge. But it is at the level at which they feel that their consent was overridden that we have to be careful. I mean, people do take drink. There's nothing wrong with it. But if you take drink, it doesn't remove all of your inhibitions. It doesn't remove all of your capacity for understanding. And if somebody goes ahead knowing the other person has not consented to that level of sexual activity, we have a problem.
Yeah. One last broad area for you, and this is maybe of interest as we go forward and try to get better as a country. And like, wouldn't it be great if in a generation or two there's verbal consent happening and we're just mature enough as a country to actually get to that point? What about overstep? I see, even trying to phrase this or have these discussions is very difficult. Overstepping the normal rhythms of courtship where there is persuasion and pressure and, you know, come back to my place. No, I don't want to. Oh, come on. And almost, back and forth. Not taking no for an answer, not physically doing anything. And then it's back to the place. And then it's, well, let's go upstairs. No, I don't want to. And again, a level of persuasion or nagging, which then the potential complainant regrets the next morning. Like, as we navigate these waters and try and educate everybody, something like that is potentially going to crop up in the future.
There is a brilliant short video done by an English police force. I think it's the Midlands Police Force. I can't remember what. Yeah. About a cup of tea. And actually, we must tweet it out from the Dublin Rape Crisis Centre this evening because it's very good. It is the story of somebody who says, look, you ask somebody back to your house for a cup of tea and they agree to come back. And then you go to make the cup of tea and by the time they come back, they've changed their mind. You don't force them to have the cup of tea. Mm-hmm. Or if they fall asleep, you don't make them wake up to have the cup of tea. Do you know? So it's just that level at which persuasion. And I think we do have a big job of work to do here, because when I think of all the romantic novels I read as I was growing up, you know, of the hero who just sort of presses the submissive victim until such time as she recognises that she was wrong all along the way. That's the kind of thing we've all grown up with.
Yeah, that is a cultural issue for sure. And like, the whole country is littered with fond married couples telling you how she said no for a date and he kept asking.
Yeah. I mean, this then, everybody has to get real about this. People who want to continue a relationship need to be able to not lie to a partner either, you know. Yeah. So there are subtleties around this. But if you bring it back down to a cup of tea, and actually when my colleagues have just told me, it's the Thames Valley Police did this particular little video. If you bring it back to the cup of tea, of course a cup of tea is very welcome a lot of the time, but only an English police force would use that as an image. But it's welcome. But when somebody doesn't want it, they're normally prepared to indicate they don't want a cup of tea if they don't want it. We should be able to say to somebody, what you're doing is no longer comfortable and I am no longer interested and I don't want you to get into a huff. Yeah. I just want you to stop where we are now.
Yeah. Phelim, final thoughts from you on this whole area? I mean, in some terms it's unbelievably complex and in others it's absolutely dead simple.
I really feel, just from my experience over the last decade dealing with these sort of matters, that consent can be a fluid thing. You know, at the start of a night, a girl might have no interest and might make it clear that she has no interest. But by the end of the night, she might have been getting on a lot better with her date and change her viewpoint. And she's perfectly entitled to do that. Mm-hmm. And that does happen.
And it happens the other way as well.
And it does happen the other way.
Yeah.
No, absolutely. There are many, many circumstances where consent is withdrawn. And I'm not saying that, but I'm just saying that it is a fluid thing. Consent can come and go. And really, it's at the moment of the act is what's important. Okay. Is consent available at that point in time? Okay. And that's the issue.
Nolene, I'll give final word to you. Do you want to sum up what you'd like to see happen more, and any other final points you want to make?
I mean, I think this should be a conversation that is taking place in the context of, you know, really a wonderful season for Ireland's rugby players. And this was a pain and a sorrow for all of them. And as kind of say, I think it is something none of them would ever have wished to be involved in. I do think it is something that rugby people are talking about right now, and we're all talking about it. So if we can talk about it and recognise that there was a lot of truth in what everybody said over the course of the trial, however horrendous the trial process is, and I maintain that it is horrendous,
yeah,
but just to recognise that it's actually one of the ways we can have a better society into the future is to have respect for each other, to try to build an understanding of each other, and to make sure that if we are going to engage with somebody as intimately as we do in sex, that we do it in a way that is absolutely consensual and to the merit of both. I would just say one other thing, Joanne, that is I'll give our phone number for anyone who might just want to talk about their own experience of any sort of sexual assault or rape, or friends or anybody who might be upset. And we have a national 24-hour helpline that we run for people all over the country, and where we'll refer people to other rape crisis centres if necessary as well. And that number is 1800 77 88 88, and it's open 24/7.
Okay, we'll leave it there. Nolene Blackwell, human rights lawyer, chief executive of the Dublin Rape Crisis Centre, and Feilim O'Neill, solicitor, who, as you heard, has been working in the area. Thanks to you both.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. Thank you.
Off the ball.
In association with the Air Sport app, allowing you to cast your favourite sporting action from your tablet or mobile phone straight to your TV.